You're listening to TIP.
Hey everyone, welcome to this week's episode of the Bitcoin Fundamentals Podcast. On today's show, we dive into the fundamentals of the Bitcoin network by talking to energy grid expert Sean Connell. This was such an eye-opening interview for me because it's not something that most of us hear or see when we think about the growth in the Bitcoin infrastructure. During the interview, Sean talks about how advantageous Bitcoin mining is to the energy sector to help offset surplus baseload generation. As you'll find in the interview, his decades of experience in energy is a fascinating angle that many might not have considered or thought about when considering how impactful Bitcoin is to this particular sector. This isn't an episode you're going to want to miss, and it's definitely a show to forward to all your friends that say Bitcoin consumes too much energy. And with that, without further delay, here's my interview with the thoughtful Sean Connell.
You're listening to Bitcoin Fundamentals by the Investors Podcast Network. Now for your host, Preston Pysh.
Hey everyone, welcome to the show. Like I said in the introduction, I'm here with Sean. Sean, I saw some clips of you talking on the internet. And I was like, oh my God, I got to get this guy on the show immediately because you were just spitting fire, man. Absolute fire. So welcome to the show. Great to have you here.
Cool. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on. I've been a big time fan for a long time. Thanks,
awesome. Preston. Well, I'm very excited to have you here. Let's start off with just your background, because what I like about your background is you started off in energy, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
I love this because this is not the normal path. So talk to us about that background and then talk to us about how Bitcoin just kind of popped up into your everyday life.
Yeah, sure. So my background is that I came into energy in 2002. And so I'm from the East Coast of Canada. I got a one-way plane ticket for graduation gift and I moved out to Calgary, Alberta. And I was essentially looking for anything and everything, any job opportunities here. I'd had like a real fascination around trading for a long time and a real interest in it. And so one of the places that I put a resume out to was called TransAlta, and it was energy marketing. And so I just finished a business degree and I thought that marketing was, kind of traditional marketing. I didn't realize that it was, the energy marketing of marketing power. And so this was right at the time in 2002 that power markets were just deregulating. Right. And so what that meant was that, companies that used to, have customers that were really just rate payers, right? They didn't have a say in anything. Essentially markets were deregulated where they separated the generation from the transmission from the person that sends you the retail bill. So in this process, a lot of these generation companies found themselves in a position where, they had a lot of generation that they now need to find a home to. And so that was kind of the genesis of trade floors coming around the year 2000. So I started in 2002 where I found a company here that was energy marketing, got a interview and they took me for a tour of the trade floor and I fell in love with it and was super excited and kind of said everything I could to get a job. And then spent the next pretty much 20 years with that company where essentially starting on a kind of an hourly desk and a real-time desk and then kind of growing up and helping kind of build this desk and leading this desk that was responsible for optimizing a fleet of natural gas generation assets in Ontario and some other assets in different markets. And what was really neat about it and kind of has this overlay with Bitcoin is that when markets were just deregulating at this time, so 2002, there was no books on how to trade power, right? It was kind of like the wild, wild west and you're trying to figure out how to make this work, right? And the people that figured out fastest and earliest were the ones that really did well and the companies that did well. And so it has an overlay with mining right now, right? Because it's kind of like this place where there's no kind of books on how to do mining and there's no agreed to commodity of saying that I believe that there's a megawatt of power and MMBtu of gas. And I think in the future, we'll talk about exahashes, which I believe is like a billion hashes. And I think that's going to be the commodity. And so there's no kind of playbooks on, how do we value the exahashes or forward market for exahashes? And what does that mean? And it really ties into miners because miners have efficiencies that how many exahash per megawatt hour they can produce based on different miners. And so really it's a perfect overlay with power plants, right? Because there's natural gas plants and they have something called a heat rate, right? And so a 7 heat rate plant uses 7 units of gas, produces 1 megawatt. A gas peaker will do, something like a 13 heat rate. But it's really the kind of this perfect overlay where you see kind of what happened in power markets and how that evolved over time and really kind of matured And then you see this kind of thing at the start of, you know, Bitcoin, right? And my introduction to Bitcoin was a friend of mine gave me a call in 2017 and longtime friend, respect his opinions. And he was telling me about how, you know, I heard of Bitcoin, and I was like, yeah, I've heard about it. And he gave me kind of the digital gold narrative, and, you know, I bought into it quite quickly. Then the question was, I said, okay, well, how much does it cost? Right. And it was, at the time it was 10,000. And I said, well, you know, how much does it cost to make? Like, how else can you get it? He says, well, you can buy it or you can mine it. And I said, okay, what's the price? It's like 10,000 to buy. And it was like 200 to make. Right. And, you know, so coming from a background in commodities is just, you know, over time, commodity prices always converge, mm-hmm. right? They arbitrage away the spread.
Yeah.
Right. And so there's this mining industry, right, where it's just this, you know, this hype happening, this excitement, and you see this kind of pulling apart, and you say, you know, like, you know, $10,000 of Bitcoin, but you can make it for 200. So like, you know, something's got to give, right? And it's going to be, you know, what's the correction? So that was kind of, you know, where I really, you know, fell in love with understanding mining for, because, you know, for me is to invest a meaningful amount of time or money in something, you really got to understand it. And so for me, that kind of started the journey where I went down this kind of rabbit hole of kind of understanding the fundamentals of mining and how they kind of, you know, the pulls on those. And so over time then, so I was at my company there, TransAlta, and then, you know, we were considering kind of, you know, should we be doing mining, right? And we were looking at, you know, what's the opportunity to do that, and realize just how much of a tremendous opportunity this was going to be. And, you know, I think about, you know, you think about just kind of like this new technology where when I was first introduced to the company that I'm with right now, it's called Lancium, right? And what they do is they essentially take these large Bitcoin mining facilities and they turn them into a power plant, but in reverse, right? And so what that means is you can, you know, dispatch down these facilities the same way as you can with a natural gas plant or a coal plant or whatnot. And you provide all the ancillary services that are kind of like, you know, backup power for a grid. And so, you know, for me at that time, it was just, I realized like how big of a role this could play. And just like, and I didn't think that.
So it was more than a light. It was more than a light bulb moment, right? Like it was like, what did I just discover?
It was kind of like there were stages of the light bulb, right? Yeah. Like the light bulb goes off and then you find out more and you're like, oh my goodness, this is a bigger light bulb.
Yeah.
Right. And then more and more and more. So that was a very long-winded way of saying that, you know, I started in energy markets, did that for 20 years, realized the comparison of energy markets and Bitcoin mining, how they're maturing. And the first 10 years of those energy markets were so exciting that I wanted to have a repeat of that and to kind of take the opportunity to say, I'm going to go join this new space with this company that's in this space and have another fun, you know, 10 plus years.
Well, let me ask you this. So when you were understanding this, and you're explaining it to other executives in the energy space, what was the reaction?
It's a great question. And so this is now my, I kind of go to observation and a little bit of opinion. So if you're an energy company that is already involved in fossil fuels, like say you're an oil and gas company,
yeah,
you're probably going to be more receptive to it, right? Because you're already kind of labeled as fossil fuels and bad, right? That, you know, taking on this initial initiative of something like Bitcoin mining, it's great because it's another way to monetize an asset, like at one of your facilities. Power generation is different, right? Because, you know, power generation is where I'm grateful for being part of, like, you know, in a career in electricity, is it's every fuel type, right? Because there's renewables, there's coal, there's natural gas, there's oil peakers before. So like you get to kind of have an exposure to all of these. And, you know, over the past 10 years, as this kind of narrative was developing around essentially this energy transition, right? Like moving to sustainable energy, is a lot of these companies are very cautious about being the first mover, right?
Yeah.
And so like, if you are, you know, a power generation company that's trying to brand yourself as renewables, what will the market say? Like, what will the market say if I've got renewables and Bitcoin mining? Is that good or bad? And this is now tying into kind of an opinion, is that I think it's going to take a large power generation company to be the first one, right? And then once they take the brunt of kind of, was this deemed to be excellent, a good idea, right? And based on the outcome of that company going forward, I think that you're going to get the companies to follow in behind, right? Because it's a remarkable way to, you know, monetize generation that previously required wires. And now you can do with, you know, Ethernet cable.
So I would describe what I think I just heard you say is they're open to the idea. But there's a massive education gap for the population to fully understand what it would even mean. And it kind of poses a potential branding issue for them until the population understands or somebody else goes out before them and kind of lays the path. That's a major energy producer that basically sets the precedence for it not being a branding issue. Is that correct? Or
yeah, that is correct. And I put on one other layer to that is that, so in 2017, what I was hearing around for other power companies was that the lack of understanding what Bitcoin was, is it a Ponzi scam? Is this going to be around for a long time? Right. Because like, if you think about like the traditional model for power generation companies is that they have, you know, they're going to be connected to the grid and they've got a couple choices to monetize that. They can, you know, one is they can inject that power into the power grid and you're going to get paid whatever the spot price of energy is for that injection point. And then the second part is that you can have, you know, customers that are, you know, behind the fence. Like there's like industrial customers where they can take steam electricity for some big industrial processes, right? And so by being behind the meter with a power plant is that you're avoiding a lot of the costs that would do with kind of the transmission distribution costs and whatnot. And so that, you know, that's the normal playbook is saying, you know, we can have behind the fence or we can do the grid. So, you know, go back to 2017 again is saying, how much of the value chain do we want to partake in? And is it really our time to extend the value chain of saying, you know, we're a power company, we produce megawatts and we sell them to customers that use those megawatts, right? And so there's, do we want to just have the same model of having miners co-locate with us the same way as these other industrial customers? Or do we think that this is something that we've developed for competencies over the past 20 years for optimizing assets that we could do a better job of saying, we're essentially going to think about this as upgrading our facility to, you know, refine local megawatts into global megawatts. And we're going to, you know, take the value side of the mining, right? Which I think is a natural fit, but that's a struggle that I think some companies will have. And just especially back in 2017 of saying, is this thing going to be around in 5 years? Should we make this CapEx investment in something that may or may not be here?
So let me ask you this, on a scale from 1 to 10, one being nobody understands it and it's nowhere to be found in the power space, to 10, everybody understands it, everybody has spent the CapEx and has it on board and it's just part of everyday operations for pretty much any energy producer in the world, where are we at today? And how fast is that trend moving on that scale from 1 to 10?
So my observation from a few years ago, so two years ago, was that we were mostly at about a 1 or 2, right? And that means that we don't understand it. There hasn't been enough mining companies going public that we can look at the appendixes and really understand how do they calculate the value of mining, right? Because that's a black box. It's like, another thing is just in the past, and this is the comparison of, you know, how I think about mining is what's the value of an exahash and what is the revenue per megawatt hour for that mining. In the mining space, it's more about what is the dollar per day per terahash, right? And so like, that's not linking to an executive at an energy company. You really don't know what that means, right? And so like, it wasn't kind of an apples to apples comparison. So we're transitioning to that. So I'd say that 2-3 years ago was a 1. People didn't know what it was. They didn't know how to value this, right? And I'd say that, you know, today is in conversations I've had with, you know, several friends that are work for other power generation companies is it's on everybody's radar, right? Like it's, and beyond on the radar, I would say that some feel like they've missed the boat and, you know, they're frustrated, right? And then others are like, well, we're still nervous about this and we still don't know what we're going to do, but we now feel more confident that it's here to stay though, right?
Yeah. So, okay. One of the things that I heard Michael Saylor say in one of his interviews was just the network effect that is now being constructed for proof of stake because of this integration with power companies and what it's going to do for them. Generically, the first question I got for you on that idea is, you know, if a power company has a top line of 100 and a bottom line, I don't know the margins here. I probably should. Let's just say the margins are what, 5-10% after tax for a power company. So we'll just say it's 5% for simplicity. But let's say the top line is 100 and the bottom line is a 5. What if that power company would fully embrace Bitcoin mining as a, as an additional strategy, what would that do to their bottom line of five? Would it bump it up to a 7 or a 10, or what are we talking here?
So it's, this would require you to be looking back in hindsight, because hindsight would tell you what you would have made for revenue per megawatt given certain machines that you have set up. So you assume that we would say like, hey, we're a company, a power generation company. We're going to do a look back over the past 4 years and assuming that we bought the latest gen miners at that time, right? Like what would been the payout difference for having that upgrade? And you know, it's massive. It's
more than doubling the bottom line.
I would say more than multiples of that, right? Because we're in this early time frame though, right? And it's just, we'll get into more details because I sometimes get down in the weeds too quick, too fast. But you know, the punchline of later are saying that, you know, the people that are getting this early are saying like Bitcoin right now is the buyer of first resort. And that means that it's willing to pay higher than the rest of the customers on the grid for the majority of hours, right? And then when energy is scarce and expensive, no problem to turn down, right? So it's going to be consuming this and it's converting those local megawatts into global megawatts. And they're getting that kind of that premium for being a first mover. So if you look back at the past, you know, 4 years, you might have received as a power generator of revenue, top line revenue, $35 per megawatt hour. If you would have purchased these miners, right, you would have had something in the neighborhood of, you know, 300, right?
Wow.
But here's the other catch on this, and this is really important, is that like you've got this CapEx depreciation schedule. Usually a power generation is like depreciate over 25, 50 years. Miners are depreciating 4 years, right? So on a new gen miner, right, that costs like say 1 megawatt, $3 million-ish, that means you have to recover $100 per hour, every hour of the year for 4 years, right? Just to recover your CapEx. Right? But you're still multiples above. And so now I'd layer on the second part of saying, you don't always have to buy new gen miners, right? So now think about like, you're ignore the kind of like the base load natural gas plant or whatnot. And let's go to a wind farm, right? And so you can look at this wind farm and you can say, in 2020, when Bitcoin price was, I think it was like 6 or 7,000 and hash rate was high, right? The revenue per megawatt hour for an S9 miner was $30. And people were giving these away for free. They say like, if you pick it up, you can take it, right? Or they were $20 a piece. And so what that works out to is you could have bought 1 megawatt of S9 miners for about $15,000, right? So compare that to the new gen miner of $3 million for megawatt. Like this is those peanuts, right? So you could then take these S9 miners and you're on some type of wind farm or solar asset. And you say, on hours when, you know, the price is too low, right? I now have an option of saying I can sell to the grid or I can sell to Bitcoin mining because I have the flexibility of my CapEx was so low. Like I don't have to try and, I'm not chasing to try and recover that CapEx spend. It's a one-time spend for infrastructure, right? And then it's almost like free for those miners.
Yeah.
Right. And so that I would say the economics are, you know, significantly higher too on these intermittent resources that can get paired with like an older miner with a lower CapEx cost.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Don't just ride the index, seek to outperform it with Fidelity Active ETFs. Learn more at fidelity.com/active ETFs. Before investing in any exchange-traded fund, you should consider its investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Contact Fidelity for a prospectus, an offering circular, or if available, a summary prospectus containing this information. Read it carefully. While active ETFs offer the potential to outperform an index, these products may more significantly trail an index as compared with passive ETFs. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Our friends at Corient provide wealth management services centered around you. Corient's goal is to exceed your expectations and simplify your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. They are one of the largest integrated fee-only U.S. registered investment advisors, and Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. They have extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. The teams at Corient put the collective power of their expertise into building you the custom wealth, investment, and family office solutions that can help you reach your holistic financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, speak with an advisor today at Corient.com. That's spelled Corient.com. That's Corient.com. When Rainn Wilson had a great idea, he turned to AT&T Business. They assured him no matter how out there his idea may be, they had his back. So he came up with this, a talking pillow designed to put you to sleep, backed by a reliable network and the only network with built-in security controls. And thus, Sleep with Rainn was a hit. Take your business to the next level at business.att.com. That's business.att.com.
All right, back to the show.
Yeah, when you just look at the energy expense, if it's truly stranded and there's just tons of energy seeping out of wherever and there's just no demand for that really, that energy, and it's priced extremely low, you're going to find all these old rigs just naturally migrate themselves to those jurisdictions because they can still make money plugging them in, even though they're pigs in what they're consuming. But the energy is spewing out anyway. And I think that's something that's lost, majorly lost with politicians and policymakers in this space is that idea. So one other thing that I want to just kind of hit on from a depreciation standpoint, I love accounting. And I'm just looking at this and you're talking about some of the multiples that come out of this, especially for new hardware. And, you know, I think if today, and you might have a better beat on this than me, but I mean, if you're capturing energy for six cents per kilowatt hour, 5 cents per kilowatt hour, and you got a new rig and you're plugging it in, you're basically doing 100% on that expense of the rig. If the rig's 10,000, you're going to make 10,000 in Bitcoin in the first year. So if you can depreciate that over a 3 to 4 year period of time, that expense, that hardware expense over 3 to 4 years, that's a nice expense to be able to write off on the income statement. And it hides a lot of the of what you're being able to retain in profits that I don't think a lot of people fully appreciate, especially maybe in the energy sector they do. But I know what you're saying. It's a lot faster cycle rate than what I think a lot of executives are used to, where they're seeing 20, 30 years of depreciation on certain pieces of hardware. And this, the hurts on this depreciation is a whole lot faster, but the return is astronomical compared to what they're used to kind of getting from just a regular consumer. So fascinating, absolutely fascinating stuff here.
And I'll kind of chat about more about kind of the stranded energy, because this gets lost on most people, right?
Please, yes.
Is that there's a belief in the world that energy is scarce everywhere and all energy is created equally, right? Like converted energy, that type of energy. So like you think about, you know, moving energy around is the easiest way to move something would be like coal, right? Put it on a truck, put it on a train, move it around. Next is, you know, oil, put it in a pipeline. Next would be kind of natural gas and, you know, pipelines as well. So the hardest one is electricity, right? Because the network of electricity, it's not like you can have an excess amount of wind and some electricity in one area and say, hey, Europe, you need some electricity, we're just going to ship it, right? It's in an area that's constrained by the wires in that area. And, you know, the investment that was made in kind of, you know, customers having a rate base that you're paying for these wires. So like, and it's really kind of back to kind of like energy is very complex. It's like there can be real pockets of excess electricity.
Yes.
Right. Without having the ability to move a load to that area, the only option is building out transmission lines. Right. And so there are cases like in West Texas where, you know, 10% of the hours last year were negative, which means that the grid operator is sending a price signal that's so low that you should turn down, right? And so that means that energy is being curtailed, right? And so that's not going anywhere. You can't ship that anywhere else. And without some type of load that's co-locating right next to it, you really are going to be like spilling wind, right? You're just going to say, you know, we can't do it. So it's just kind of an important point that, and most don't understand, is that you can have energy abundance in certain areas and not in others. And I think about kind of the idea that I'm from Alberta and, you know, back in the 80s that, you know, people would go buy land for like the mineral rights that were underneath them. And all you had to think was, is oil going to be valuable in the future? Because if it is, I got long oil just from buying some land. And, you know, I think about this in kind of, you know, in the renewable space right now is that, you know, there's been these massive deposits of wind and solar in certain areas, given the certain kind of the geography, the weather and whatnot, that you couldn't tap into before because there was no power lines there. You couldn't monetize it, right? And so for the first time in history now, you can actually bring a load to this deposit of sunshine and wind that couldn't get tapped into before because you couldn't pull it out of there. Mm-hmm. So that's a neat concept. It's that Bitcoin's really unlocking.
It's almost like the ultimate capacitor that you could stick anywhere with near perfect efficiency. Would you describe it that way, or would you describe it in a simplified kind of way? Would you describe it different?
So I'd start with is that, you know, power generation provides two services, two main services, right? They provide energy to the grid for real-time supply-demand balance, and they provide backup power, which is called ancillary services, in case something unexpected happens, and you can come online and to make up for that, right? And so up until now, like, demand has been perfectly inelastic, right? Because you know, what's the price of energy right now for you where you're at, Preston?
I would say 11 cents per kilowatt hour, 12 cents, something like that.
And you're guessing what the real-time 5-minute price is in your area.
Yeah.
But if it was really, really high, you wouldn't know and you couldn't turn down because you don't have the required equipment or telemetry in your house to respond to prices.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And you know, how much would you really turn down if a price signal went to a certain point is, you know, maybe limited. And they're improving on this and having loads that are responsive to price. But so I guess kind of like, and I mentioned this on Peter's podcast, but you know, just to zoom out, right, and to say that I think that when you frame Bitcoin mining as is it just or not, right? Like, everybody's going to come away with a different opinion. And you're not going to get everybody on board, right? That's a really hard thing to do, right? But if you think about what we've been fortunate about in Bitcoin and mining, how it relates to energy, is that, you know, for the past, you know, several years, countries have been pledging to say net zero emissions by 2050 is one of the main timelines, right? It's a real noble thing to do, and it's the right thing to do, but there's a ton of implications on that. And so what it means is that to go to an economy where you're net zero emissions means that you need to electrify everything, right? And that means that, you know, cars go from combustion engine, you're going to go to EVs, right? Buildings are going to be electric. And so that means you're going to have a lot more electricity demand because you're going to electrify everything. And it works out to be about a 3x in electricity demand over a 30-year period. Electrifying everything at the same time is that to decarbonize means that you're going to retire fossil fuel generation, which is your natural gas and your fossil fuel plants and coal and whatnot. And, you know, so what are you going to replace that with, right? And so the answer has been that you can replace it with renewables. Hydrogen is part of the solution. But in this example is that you're going to essentially negative 1x your fossil fuels, and you need to 15x your wind and solar capacity from current levels, right?
Yeah. So, that don't work on a variance level.
Right? Right? So like, you know, zooming out again, it's like, you know, 3x electricity demand, negative 1x fossil fuels, 15x wind and solar. And so what that's going to do is it's going to create a lot more volatility for kind of intermittency on the grid, right? When is the wind blowing? When is the sun shining? And to balance that, right, is what you need to have is you need to have flexible resources, right? And new flexible resources that, you know, aren't fossil fuels, but resources that can come to the grid and can balance during those periods. And so I'll use an example of in ERCOT, there's 10 gigawatts of solar right now, and their average demand is approximately 45 gigawatts. Over the next year and a half, they're going to go from 10 gigawatts to about 20 gigawatts. So on this average day, about half of your generation has come from solar. So what happens when the sun goes down at the end of the day is you have this really big 2-hour ramp period where you need to bring on a whole lot of resources to make up for the fact that you're losing, you know, your solar resources. And the current solution right now is natural gas, right? It's a great load balancing resource, phenomenal, right? But what happens when you lose these is that you need to have new resources that can do this. And so, you know, going back to the example is with all this intermittency, you essentially need to have a 4x on your flexible resources that you have available to the grid. And currently, 95% of flexibility comes from generation right now. And 1% comes from demand response in batteries. And then the IEA put out this this publication, and their forecast says that, you know, batteries and demand response need to do 50%. So you're going to go from 1% to 50%. Right. And so what is Bitcoin mining? Right. And so Bitcoin mining is demand response.
Yeah.
And it's the, you know, the Rolls Royce of demand response. It's like, it's the pinnacle. And the way this is that, you know, think about, you know, the current Rolls Royce of demand response for industrial manufacturing would be the steel plant. And the reason why is It's got one single energy intensive application, which is the arc furnace. Mm. Right. And, you know, there's literally somebody that's, you know, sitting by a switch. And when they say, you know, we're going to come down for a couple hours, they hit the button, right? And they can come down for 2 hours, right? And they're going to drop 95% of their peak electricity demand. And, but they can only do it for like 2 hours. And the reason is because the steel is going to harden. It's going to turn into ignot. It's going to cause a whole bunch of problems. So you got to turn the arc furnace back on. And so that's, you know, an example of demand response. It's the best one that there is today until Bitcoin mining. And so now the way to think about Bitcoin mining is the arc furnace is like that assembly line, right? So you're kind of going through this process and you have the arc furnace and then it goes to a ladle and I forget all the other pieces, but it's kind of like an assembly line for like a car. They got to go through these stages. And so you got to interrupt the process when you do this demand response. And so Bitcoin mining, if you think about like a 100 terahash per second Bitcoin miner, that's the equivalent of saying you have a machine that can start, finish, and monetize 100 trillion jobs per second.
Right? It's unreal.
So there's no work in progress, right? Like it's completed jobs, right? So you didn't have wasted effort prior to that, right? That was throwaway, right? It was, you were able to stop it immediately and you turned down and as soon as their price, you know, changes, or if you've been called on to provide one of these ancillary services, you can go back up, but you've got the ultimate flexible resource now that can do this type of load balancing.
When I think about all the issues that you've kind of seen crop up in the last 5 to 10 years with the inflexibility of the grid, all around the world, I know you guys have had issues in Canada and the US, all over. This solves that problem. It makes the grid robust. And so when I'm thinking of it from just a policy standpoint, it just seems so obvious that this needs to be embraced by across both party lines, whether you're a conservative, liberal, whatever. It just seems like such an obvious solution to a real world problem that both parties would want solved. Do you think that it's moving politically? And maybe you can only talk to on the Canadian side. Do you feel like it's moving in the right direction politically, that people or decision makers are understanding these very strong arguments as to why this needs to be built into the grid?
Yeah. So I live in Canada, but the company I work for, Lancium's Houston-based company, and I'm down there half the time. So I'm pretty well-versed with ERCOT. So that's kind of where I've been spending a lot of my time. And about a month ago, the interim CEO of ERCOT, his name is Brad Jones, I was looking on YouTube and I saw this, it was a CNBC clip and it was Brad Jones and it was talking about mining, right? And so I flipped it on and my jaw dropped, right? Because so ERCOT has been the early adopter of these controllable loads, right? And a controllable load is what allows you to turn these power generators in reverse. They have the benefit that they are an islanded electricity grid where they're not connected to the rest of the US, which allows them to do things without needing FERC approval, which is a federal approval. So they can experiment and do things faster than others. And they've been very kind of, you know, I call it the entrepreneurial, the mindset, like down in Texas. And so these controllable loads have been coming on in Texas, and you've probably seen in the news some of these large sites that are coming online. And so the interview was with Brad Jones, and it was kind of like, it was the ultimate perfect interview that you would kind of say, what would you hope the CEO of the power system that is being kind of bombarded with massive amounts of Bitcoin mining, what is he saying about this, right? And his message was, one of them he said was saying, hey, we've got this amazing wind and solar resource in Texas. We want to build that out and we want to have some type of load that can soak up that excess renewables because you don't want to turn down that resource, right? So one part he said, he also commented about how when there's a plant that could trip offline is that there's been a track record for these loads being able to do frequency response, right? And what that means is that, you know, the heart rate of the grid is at 60 hertz per second, right? And so if something trips offline, right, the heart rate changes and you can't wait for a dispatch. You got to automatically sense, like these power generators do, they automatically sense there's a change in the frequency. And then they kind of like inject more power, or for these controllable loads is they turn down, right? And so they do this right away. And so he made a comment in his video about how, you know, that's been proven that this is working in the state. And then he's kind of tying back into that. There's certain types of flexible resources. There's four categories, right? There's power generation. There's interties, right? So that's your grid connectivity. There's batteries and there's demand response. And so ERCOT's an island, right? And it's an island that doesn't have hydro, right? And hydro is a great flexible resource, right? It's like a battery, it's storage, right? So they don't have any batteries. And since they're an island grid, they can't lean on their connections with the rest of the United States to pull power if there's any type of problem. So they really got to be self-supporting, right? And so Brad Jones's message was saying that they're really embracing these miners because they're offering a lot of flexibility to their grid operators. And it's essentially like a grid operator's Swiss Army knife.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, I can use this for backup power. I can use this for energy, depending on how the owner of the facility has offered it into their grid. But it's this great resource for helping them, you know, balance their grids, especially as they're transitioning to more renewables.
Well, and they can give them what they want as the miners, what they want as well, because they can give them a sweetheart deal in pricing of the energy that they're consuming as the homeostasis back to the power generator is that flexibility and having that there to have that agreement in place to either turn them off or leave them on, right? So I would think that in the negotiation of some of these contracts with some of the larger miners, the incentives kind of align for them to get along, right?
Yeah. And so there's, you know, zooming back out on like power markets is that, mm-hmm. You know, some I hear often in the news that said that, you know, a miner got paid by ERCOT to turn down, mm-hmm. right? Which is false, right? Because there's different types of, again, back to the components, there's your wholesale generation, there's your wires company, your utility company, and then your retail supply side. And so when you go into a market like ERCOT, which is deregulated, is that if you go into some utility company area where it's an investor-owned utility, right, which is approximately, I think, it's about two-thirds of Texas, that means that the rate for the transmission is set by the Public Utility Commission, mm-hmm. right? So there's no negotiating, right? It's just, this is what the rate is, and it's great because it's transparency, right? Like, it's not backdoor deals or something like that, right? So like, you know what you're going to be getting. And on the energy side is that you're going to be purchasing energy from the grid operator who's, ERCOT, all they're doing is they're a clearinghouse, right? And they're essentially taking all the generation and they're saying, who's willing to sell power for what price? I'm going to stack it up and here's where the demand is. I'm going to set the price at that marginal megawatt. And so if you're in one of these areas where it's an investor-owned utility, you're essentially able to buy at the spot price, right? And so at this clearing price. And you can also do hedging for that location, which is essentially a contract for differences, because you're going to buy your physical power from the grid operator. And then you can have this financial hedge on the side that's like a contract for differences to kind of, you know, hedge that risk. So in the example where somebody says, for example, in Winter Storm Uri went through ERCOT February 2021, caused very high prices. And there were a lot of miners that did very well. And the reason was is because they turned offline, right? And so they weren't consuming energy during this event. And they had this contract for differences hedge, right? And so they'd entered into a contract for differences hedge where it's saying, you know, we bought at $50 per megawatt for X number of years around the clock. And then prices during that time settled, you know, there were several days that settled at $9,000. It was the black swan of black swans, right? And so they got paid on this contract for differences, right? And so they didn't get paid by ERCOT. They just did the right thing, right? They did what made sense, is saying, this price is way too high for me, right? I can't afford to pay for that. I just need to be offline, which is good for everybody else because energy is scarce. And, you know, had that same miner said, I'm not going to, instead of turning down, I'm going to be selling ancillary services. I'm going to run and I'm going to be the best low cost option providing ancillary service. Well, ERCOT's going to pay them for that ancillary service and the miner's going to pay for the energy and you net those two together. And that's kind of like the net cost that they would have had. But, you know, kind of back to the point of saying ERCOT's not making arrangements with miners on saying, hey, to turn down. It's what's great about Texas. It's very open market and here's the rules. And
And so the essence of what you're getting at is humans that need power at emergency periods of time or in a more competitive space are going to out-prioritize Bitcoin mining just naturally through an open market competitive environment. Which I think people that are hearing this, that might be a concern that they have. Is there listening to this, like, well, these things are going to take over. If the margins are that fat, they're just going to take over and the person who just wants to turn on the power at their house aren't going to be able to do it. But what you just described is not that. Fascinating stuff. My gosh.
So think about this. It's like, so for these new gen miners, their break-even right now is about $200 a megawatt. And the average price for the past 5 years or so has been about $50, right? So like they're well above the average, but whenever there's price spikes, they turn down, right? And so some of the education that needs to be shared with folks on this is saying that they're always going to be turned down when the price is above 200, right? But imagine the story of saying this miner only turns online when the price is below $20, right? And so this miner is only going to consume like that super excess energy. And you can tell it's excess because it's so cheap.
Cheap, yeah.
Right. Everybody, I think, would be saying, holy crap, right? That's amazing. We can put these, you know, facilities next to these renewables. And since power is mostly always over $20, right, they'll be turning off. Like, this is the greatest thing in the world, right? So it's, you know, this is where I get excited about this as well, is that, you know, where the power market started in 2000 versus where they are now in 2020 was much different, right? And so where mining is today and where it's going to be in, you know, 10, 20 years is completely different, right? And so like, we're going to have a great experiment in the next year because, you know, for a long time, these miners have had such a high break-even point. They're running 95% of the time, right? Because prices only go above that certain amount of hours per year. Over the past 16 months, gas prices tripled. And over the past 4 months, it's more than doubled, right? And in power markets, is that natural gas is your marginal unit, right? It's the one that balances your real-time load supply. So for, again, back to the past 5 years is, you know, $35, $40. The price of power for the balance of year across the United States now with this 3X in gas prices is north of $100, right? And in certain periods like summer, you know, the average price for the, they call them peak hours, which is Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m, you know, that's priced in at $200. And the off peak, which are the morning hours, is priced at $100. And so the average for summer is $150, right? So what happens if you have an S9 miner in ERCOT, right? And your break even right now is $80, right? Like that miner's coming offline.
It's coming off, right? Yeah.
And some of these other miners that are, you know, I talked about that $200 average. That means that there's going to be several hours above $400 or $500 if this materializes, right? Because it's just the average of, you know, the entire, the month's averages for those peak hours. So I think that we're going to see for the balance of years, and this is where, you know, mining has an opportunity to shine, is you're going to see this evidence of these miners turning down because if power prices have tripled, that means the economics of mining has gone down, right? Which, and I've listened to you on other podcasts and that you think about kind of the price of mining is the floor for energy, right? We've just tripled the floor.
Yeah.
And so like you've now priced out a bunch of these miners, right? And if they do another doubling of, you know, hash rate over the balance of the year, you know, that means that it's, you know, it's twice as more difficult on the mining, right? And so like it's in kind of listening to you in the past, it sets up that kind of next push, right?
Yes.
But the real story on this is like, I think we're going to have evidence at the end of the year on just how these miners were operating in an environment when power prices were very high, right? And you'll see them turning down at different times that even when there wasn't scarcity events, because the power prices were just too high, right? Which goes back to that narrative saying, you know, in the long run, Bitcoin will be the buyer of last resort, but we need to transition there and it's going to take time. But with this extreme vol that's happening right now this year in power markets, we're going to get it's going to foreshadow what that looks like, I believe. So it'll be a pretty neat year to see that.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey guys, do you ever wonder how investors like Peter Thiel have Roth IRAs worth billions? Many do more than just save a portion of their income, invest it in the stock market, and cross their fingers and hope it grows enough to retire on. The secret is they use something called a self-directed IRA, which has all the tax advantages we love, but with a twist. Instead of being stuck with stocks, bonds, and cookie-cutter options, a self-directed IRA with New Direction Trust Company allows you to invest your retirement savings in what you know and what you're passionate about. From real estate to startups to gold and silver, there are nearly unlimited investment options. You could even finance and set the terms of a loan. You name it, NDTCO will help you fund it. We're not saying you'll be the next Peter Thiel, but we're not saying that either. Because his secrets are now your secrets. Check out New Direction Trust Company and self-directed IRAs today at ndtco.com and unlock the potential of your retirement savings. That's ndtco.com. Kyle, you're connected with a ton of different investors and portfolio managers, and you're just really in the know on a lot of these things. How do you keep up with all the day-to-day headlines for your portfolio companies?
Yeah, so I used to have a ton of issues with this, and that was until I started using Yahoo Finance.
Really? What's so great about it?
So Yahoo Finance is awesome. I have my whole portfolio entered, and I can easily see all the top headlines to keep up with the recent news. And each day you get an overview of the major global events that might be moving the market. So I'm ready to easily pounce on any opportunities that come my way.
What else can you do on Yahoo Finance's platform?
They also have a number of cool features, including a tool that lets you link all of your investment accounts, analyst ratings, and independent research, as well as the ability to create customized charts.
Well, now I know that the audience is really going to love this one. And I actually see they have 90 million monthly active users.
For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit the brand behind every great investor, yahoofinance.com.
The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. You can earn 4 times points on your top 2 eligible spending categories every month, like transit, U.S. restaurants, and gas stations. That's the powerful backing of American Express. 4 times points on up to $150,000 in purchases per year. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.
All right, back to the show.
And I think to your point as well is those rigs that are in a geographic location that is not turned on because of the prices, they're going to sell them. They're going to sell them to other geographic locations where the energy costs, hey, maybe they've got a volcano, maybe they got something else that is generating energy at an extremely low cost, and they're just going to gobble those things up for pennies on the dollar and plug them back in. Is there anything that you're seeing this from a different lens than most people in the space that I've talked to, at least? Is there anything that's going to stop this or slow this down at this point? Or is there so much momentum in the energy space to lean into this?
I feel very confident that it's going to keep going, right? Yeah. I never want to say never on this stuff, right?
But just,
if you check the boxes and say, what is Bitcoin mining? Like it's kind of like, that rabbit hole of, for me, my experience was that you go into Bitcoin and then it takes a 3-year rabbit hole of like, what is money and what problems being solved? And it's an amazing rabbit hole that gets you into all these books that you never thought you'd read, and just it's phenomenal, right? And so I feel like we're now, accidentally kind of getting the benefit of Bitcoin solving another big issue.
Yes.
And saying, what is energy, right?
Amen to this. I'm right with you 100%.
And I think that Nick Carter was early to recognize this, and so
very.
He's been, right, and he's just like, I think this is like that that really important piece of information that we need to really figure out, right, so that we can and I shared this on Peter's podcast, is that something I think is really important for everybody to be educated in the space and to understand, the value is that, if nuclear generation was invented today, it would be the magic pill, right? We wouldn't have all these, perceptions and beliefs about this being bad and that it's going to be, right? It'd be like, we found it, right? And so, the concern I have is that we're at this very pivotal place for Bitcoin where it's hard to put the pieces together about why this is, amazing for energy, amazing for money, and has these great characteristics. But if it goes down this wrong path, and then too many people start believing a certain thing, and then it starts, an executive order happens, right? And you have to ban mining. That's a fear where I feel like we're ahead of the narrative now, and it's starting to kind of pick up. And my observation is that for the past few years, is miners are tremendously smart folks that know their business inside and out. But when asked for, how's Bitcoin benefiting renewables, they're like, I'm not too sure, but I just know it is, right? And so now it feels like the pieces are coming out where it's really data backed, and you can see it, and you're like, yes, right? Like now I can communicate this and share that. So
it takes a lot of effort, and it takes a lot of different voices of people to lay out all the evidence, and there's a lot of research there to kind of piece that together and be able to view it from that lens. But I think we're at that point now where we have enough people and enough sources. For example, the Saylor and Jack Dorsey response to Congress just this past 3 or 4 days ago, responding to, I don't know how many questions were laid out here. It looks like eight different questions in this document. And I mean, they just take it task by task, laying out why there's confusion in some of these questions. Did you have a chance to go through, I'm curious, did you have a chance to go through that document and see how they responded to some of these things?
I did. And I think that, I think Nick Carter might've been on there as well. I think he might've mm-hmm. had an influence on the writing of that document.
Yeah.
Right. And so I have, and I think that our signature's on the back on one of the last pages, our company. So yeah, it's just, yeah, it's great that we now have the information and they did a wonderful job preparing that response.
I'm going to read one here. I don't want to take away from the questions here, but I love this response to one of the questions here. And I just want to read this for the people listening. One of the questions, it states, we have serious concerns regarding reports that Bitcoin mining facilities across the country are polluting communities and having an outsized contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. Less energy intensive cryptocurrency mining technologies such as proof of stake are available and have 99.99% lower energy demands than proof of work to validate transactions. So this was the response in the paper. This is, once again, misleading. Proof of stake is not a mining technology. It is a technique to determine authority over a distributed ledger, but it does not achieve decentralized distribution. Moreover, it has a much more limited track record, is controlled by founders, has single points of failure, and it remains dubious as to whether proof of stake can effectively govern a global apolitical monetary system in a manner like proof of work. And it goes on and on, and just some of these responses in here were just absolute fire. And it's nice to know that we have a community of people that are, you know, taking them on blow by blow. Who eats who here? Do the energy companies eat the mining companies, or do the mining companies eat the energy companies?
I don't know if it's a framing of who eats who. I think it's more of where does the market share go, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of, you think about kind of the hash rate market share, and I'm making this up and I'm going to be wrong, is that, you know, say it's public mining companies are 75% and the rest 25%, right? So like in the future, what is the blend of, you know, public mining companies, you know, public or private energy companies, other mining companies? And, you know, I think that there's the actors in the space on the energy side, right? They all see this value, right? And they recognize that the current customer they have, which is a grid, you know, sometimes is a great customer, but you know, if you owned a business, wouldn't you rather have two customers versus one, right? Like you can almost look at this as like, and the way that I was thinking about it when I was with TransAlta is just like, you know, what would it cost to buy a, you know, strip of put options on power, right? And it's just like, well, you can buy the miners for cheaper than that. So like, you're actually, you know, arbing the price of these put options, assuming you've got the capacity of doing that, right? It was the same thing with those Bitcoin miners when they were virtually free in 2020 and saying, what is the cost of a strip of call options on Bitcoin price? It's like, well, what's the cost of these Bitcoin miners? Cause there's an arb there, but you need the infrastructure to plug it in. So I just see these as like, it's not like these energy companies are going to be saying, I believe that these energy companies are going to be all in where all they're doing is mining, right? They're going to be saying, hey, we need to have different options for monetizing our energy. And there's certain benefits that accrue to all by them doing that. And so it's just, yeah, I see a future where another big reason for, you know, education on the mining side here is that we often frame it, you know, this back in the category of kind of, is it a good use of energy? And, you know, one of the common rebuttals is saying that we just use a fraction of the energy of the world, right? Which is true right now. But if it does what we think it's going to do, right, then that means that, you know, the 15 gigawatts today in 10 years from now is more like 300 gigawatts, right? Which is not insignificant, right? And so that kind of, we probably have to shift away from that, you know, from, again, of just like, is this good use of energy versus saying, you know, do we think of batteries as green or dirty, right? Because batteries are injecting power into their, withdrawing power from the grid and then injecting back into the grid. Are we assessing like who's getting those megawatts that are coming out of the battery? It's like, no, this is a tool for the transition, right? Like, and if you think about kind of like an uptime, it's maybe like a 50%. It's half the time it's injecting, withdrawing, right? Whereas mining can be up 95% of the time. And for these miners that are old gen miners, they can be at the money where they can be, you know, 50% up and down. But when you frame it more on saying that this is a tool that helps with these transitions, you kind of get away from that, having to say this, you know, is it just use of energy and we're just insignificant on the total quantity. But so my prediction in the future is that I'll use 20 years out because anything's possible in 20 years. And it's hard to say that's wrong. Is that when, you know, the current cost for a megawatt of wind and a megawatt of solar is roughly $1 million. And the infrastructure required for a racking solution for miners is, call it $250,000. And so now think about, you're doing this new wind project or solar project. Bitcoin's been around for 30 years, right? And you're saying, okay, I want to go to the, you know, connect to the grid. And actually, you're probably not saying I'm going to connect to the grid. You're saying, how do I monetize this? Your starting point, right? It's going to probably be a blend of, you know, mining and the grid. And so in the future, I predict that the decisions on when you're doing this capital outlay for wind and solar projects will just naturally have this $250,000 purchase for your racking solution. And you'll have a strategy that, you know, after, you know, every one of these halvings or just during these down periods where you have public miners with lots of capital that can replace these miners and essentially retire the old ones, you're going to have these renewables projects just sit on the side just as a floor, like a bid, right? And so they'll say, we'll take whatever you got because we're just going to put this here and this is better than getting paid negative 10 if we inject to the grid, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's going to go part in that decision. And, that, like, and that's every energy company will say, you know, how do we think about, you know, pairing this with some type of racking solution that allows us a non-wires alternative for selling our power?
How do you think about the centralization of mining rigs with all of these mining companies? Now, anybody who understands the space knows that these miners participate in pools and they can reallocate their hash rate to whatever pool if they feel like, you know, one pool operator is not doing the right thing and that it's becoming too centralized or whatever. But what are your thoughts on so much of the miners being controlled by large companies now? Do you have any thoughts around that idea?
I think it could kind of goes into the category of maybe in the category of, you know, mining pools and hash rates, and that there's, you know, now there's a blend of, and I haven't looked in a long time, but say it's, you know, 10 big pools and 10%, and it's not a central attack. But, you know, I generally think that, again, it's kind of, you know, I bought a Tesla in 2014 where I flew out to Vancouver and I drove it back to Calgary and it was a nightmare because there's no charging stations and it took me like 2.5 days. And there's a lot of stories behind that. But that state of 2014 when there was no charging stations is much different now in 2022 where I can go anywhere and charge these things, right? And so, you know, framing kind of the decentralized mining is just like, we're now at 15 gigawatts. So like there might be pockets of centralization. But you go to 300 gigawatts and it's a global mining operation, right? It becomes less of, I think, less of an issue because it's not just focused on a region in the US or in some types of states. It's gotten to some, you know, massive adoption level that it's very global, distributed, and the size of the capacity of megawatts or you know, securing the network is much larger. Massive, so I think it's less significant in the future.
Yeah, I agree. Here's one I got for you, Sean. When we look at the price action, call it 5 years ago, 7 years ago of Bitcoin, and we look at how much hardware had to come online to capture the spread or the margin that was created out of those price runs, you could bring quite a bit of hardware online relative to that price jump and then capture the margin, capture the spread, and bring it back into a production cost. We saw this in 2018. Enough hardware came online. It, you know, the price was coming in at, I want to say, like 8,000. And then you saw a big capitulation because basically all the hardware that kind of came online from that peak into the following year brought the spreads down significantly. And there just wasn't a whole lot of margin to be made. And you went into a minor capitulation and everything kind of reset itself. That happened fairly quickly. I think today, when we look at the spread that currently exists, the margin that exists, it's still pretty massive. We've had a 50%, for all intents and purposes, we'll just call it a 50% pullback from the all-time high that was set at close to 70,000. And the margin is still there. And it doesn't seem like the hash rate is picking up at a pace that would capture that nearly as quick. And when I'm thinking about this dynamic that's playing out, I'm thinking, well, it requires so much more hardware now to come online to capture that spread. What in the world would happen if the price went on a real tear and let's say it went to 200,000 or 300,000? It's almost as if the price appreciation doing these big jumps, it's harder for the physical infrastructure to keep pace to capture those spreads as the price would continue to potentially run. Are you seeing that way, or am I out in crazy land with how I'm looking at this? It almost seems like it's not a linear comparison as the price would continue to go higher.
So I think that, like, over time, these come back and they make sense, right? And just like something that kind of got me excited recently with this power price move is, you know, it actually made the economics of mining not so good, right? And so, like, you know, because if you had this miner that was in 2017 that was making $500 a megawatt hour for some months, and then in 2020 it was down to 30, right? And so, like, it was kind of like, and again, just like this overlay of power generation is like, there's this kind of similar behaviors where it's power companies will build generation because even though the market says they don't need it, they think that when they put it online, it's going to be there, right? And, you know, I come from a trading background. I say there's a better way to express that view than to build an asset that's out of the money on the start, right? Like, you could buy call options on power that could accomplish that instead of buying this really big, you know, physical asset. And maybe you couldn't get off the amount of volume that you want to do. But so I see these behaviors that are happening in mining that overlay the same behaviors because people, there's just people making decisions. And so right now we're at a point where I mentioned that, you know, summer power across the United States is going to be like $150, $200, right? Which means that these new gen miners are going to be out of the money, right? And so in Europe, the price of natural gas in Europe is something like $25 to $30 an MMBTU. And here in the United States today, it's about $8, right? So that means that, like, you can't do mining in Europe because gas is three times more expensive there, which means the power is way too expensive, right? And the power prices here, right? Like, if you would have gone back in January, margins were fat, right? Like, it was good because this big gas move hadn't happened. So I think we're experiencing that right now.
Wow.
Is that these miners that were deep in the money are actually, you know, some are getting out of the money. Some of these new gen miners are, you know, might need to turn off for some periods during the summer times and later in the year. So I think we're kind of in that mode right now. So I don't think the margins are really good right now for these miners. Well, step back is like, they're okay right now for the last 2 months.
But they're not nearly as fat as they were before the big macro energy moves that we're seeing.
That's right. And like, the price of power year to date has been like $45.
Yeah.
Right. And the price for the balance of year is 120.
Wow. Right?
So, like, comparing the economics for the past, you know, 4 months isn't the right proxy for, you know, what's coming up. And so, you know, back to, again, your narrative where, you know, this mining set in this floor, I think there's going to be some hash rate coming offline at that time because it's uneconomic and you're going to see some
that is fascinating.
Discomfort.
That is fascinating to me.
Yeah, right.
Because so I'm looking at it and I'm saying, hold on a second. The infrastructure cannot keep pace with what, you know, I kind of suspect the price is going to do in the coming 5 to 10 years. But I never thought of it from the perspective of the energy cost kind of blowing out in fiat terms and how that's going to cause not issues, but that's going to help keep everything much more in balance. And you're not going to see such a drastic spread because everybody today is still denominating those expenses for the hardware in fiat terms. And so they're looking at it in fiat terms as they're paying their energy bills until we eventually get to a point where everything's going to be denominated in Bitcoin. We'll see where it goes, right?
You've got some advanced thinking there, Preston.
That's interesting. No, I love that. I love your comeback on that because it lessens the burden of it being so obvious to energy producers because the spread would be 300% plus and it'd just be super obvious.
And I think that we're now maturing in, so again, it's like reference of kind of power markets when they're deregulating 2000 to 2010. Mm-hmm. I remember trading New England power market, which is a lot of natural gas there. And there's expensive natural gas in New England because there's not many pipelines. It's kind of constrained up in that area. And, you know, you would see the price of power for the next day at $200. And you do the math and you say, do you know what? Like, based on the price of gas, right, it makes more sense for them to sell back their gas and to not run their plant than to run their plant because that'd be uneconomic. It'd be a bad decision, right? And I got burned so many times in the beginning, in like, you know, 2003, 2004, 2005, because these companies hadn't developed the capabilities in-house or through third parties to essentially make those changes for how they're dispatching these generation assets. And so we're starting to see that now in the mining space too, right? Because you'll see, you know, some of these miners that maybe they don't turn down all the way because, you know, they're just realizing that they've got this, you know, this facility that can be dispatched up and down and it has this additional flexibility. So it's, you know, kind of, you know, the takeaway on this is that the same way power generation had to mature as this deregulation happened, we're seeing that maturity happen with these mining companies as they get bigger and more sophisticated and kind of how they're operating their sites, right? So it's a very similar reference.
What is something that most people are misunderstanding or just totally missing about this particular space right now?
I would say that, so I was making a presentation to an independent market monitor about kind of the benefits. And this is somebody that would kind of look at ISO, one of the jurisdictions for the rules, and essentially make some suggestions on, you know, how could they improve their market, right? And so they're responsible for being this third party that can look at the market and then make suggestions to the state or the utility commission on how to improve. And so I presented to them 2 years ago. And what I was trying to communicate was saying, the same way you think about batteries, that you can put them on certain parts of the grid to relieve congestion, right? Because they can come up and down and they can, you know, respond to price signals, is that I would encourage them to think about these controllable loads as the same way. And the reason was is because, and this goes back to kind of how power markets were formed over the last 100 years, and load being not responsive, right? So load can't respond to price, it's perfectly inelastic. And so generation will get paid at essentially the node they inject in the grid. It's called the LMP price, locational marginal price. So they get paid at that node. Whereas a load will take the average of the volumetric weighted average across all the nodes in a certain area, and they're going to get the average price. And so the message I was communicating with this independent market monitor was saying, encourage you to think about these as, you know, the same as batteries, and these should get actually LMP pricing, right? Because, you know, they can actually relieve congestion at that point, and you also, you want to send the right price, right? You want to have the right signal. You want to have the right market behavior, market outcome, pardon me, that says, hey, there's cheap electricity up here. Go locate load here. And if you can have like that nodal price. And so after winter storm Uri, and, you know, the observation, some reading says that, you know, when power systems get to about 25% renewables, so it means you look back and 25% energy came from wind or solar, they need to do these market reforms on rules and products for managing the grids. Because when power markets were created, deregulated in 2000, it's like there was no wind or solar, right? So of course the market rules, you know, wouldn't have taken that into consideration. So long way of saying this is that, like, when I was sharing this information with the market monitor, I was saying the reason why it's probably not on your radar is because on 2017, this is Bitcoin mining. I showed a picture of a 2 megawatt container in some industrial park and a transformer on it, right? And then I shared a picture of what the Rockdale site looks like in Texas, which guy named Chad puts up there on his Twitter and copied and pasted that there. And you can see this is what it looks like. And then I shared a picture and said, this is what it can look like in the future. And it has, like, mm-hmm. you know, battery banks and, you know, located right by solar and wind, et cetera. And it was just kind of their jaw dropped, right? And so what they're missing was it's happened so fast, right? Yes. That you went from 2 megawatt containers to, you know, this Rockdale facility with Riot is now like coming up along like north of 500 megawatts. I think it's coming online here soon, right? And so it's happened
That's
so
unreal.
Fast. It's not surprising. It's not on the radar, right? And so what's lost on people is just, you know, the impact that these facilities can have because of the size they are and how they can, you know, balance these grids and provide the same services as generators. But if you think of these as just like these 2 megawatt containers, it's like, come on, right? There's not enough scale there, right? And so what's lost on people, I think, is just how big it is. Yeah.
It's unreal. Sean, I can't thank you enough. We have got to do this again. You are such a wealth of information. Give people a hand off to your Twitter. I'll definitely, you know, when we post this, people are going to see your account. But man, you need people following you because you just have such a breadth of knowledge. My gosh. Give them a hand off to your Twitter and anything else that you want to highlight.
Awesome. Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show, Preston. I was excited that you reached out to me. So
yeah.
Thanks for having me on. People can reach me on Twitter. It's at Sean Energy, so S-H-A-U-N, and then Energy. And, you know, most of the stuff that we've shared here today, I post a lot of kind of, you know, pictures and slides and stuff like that on this. So yeah, I'd love for people to reach out to me. And yeah, I think that's it.
And one final question for you. If you have a quick message to any policymakers that listen to the show, what would your message be to the policymakers? as they're trying to wrap their head around all this stuff?
Yeah. So I think as a first stop, I'd encourage them all to go listen to Brad Jones's, you know, 5-minute CNBC clip. And you say, as a policymaker, saying, you know, what is the CEO of the grid that has the most amount of mining that's had some, you know, challenges with some outages in the past years? Think about this, right? And that's a, you couldn't have somebody promote it any better than him. And then I would say, just kind of like, you know, list off like 4 bullet points on saying, you know, like, why is Bitcoin a great tool for the energy transition? And you know, first I'd say, this is a tool for energy flexibility. Is you're having a lot more intermittent resources. You need to have something for balancing the grid. This is something that provides second as ancillary services. So like all the backup generation that's been used in the past, like this is new flexibility for these intermittency. You've now got a global floor price of energy, right? So anybody around the world can monetize a generation asset now with mining. And then last is just a cherry on the top is you've got a new offtaker for renewables, where you know some of these renewable projects that were kind of stranded in certain areas is struggling to find a buyer because, you know, they were being curtailed or wouldn't have a buyer. You now have somebody that can come to this area and kind of support the growth of this renewable space.
I'm going to have Brad's clip in the show notes if people want to watch that. Sean Connell, thank you so much for coming on the show. My goodness, you knocked this one out of the ballpark, sir.
Thanks, Preston. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. If you guys enjoyed this conversation, be sure to follow the show on whatever podcast application you use. Just search for We Study Billionaires. The Bitcoin-specific shows come out every Wednesday, and I'd love to have you as a regular listener. If you enjoyed the show, or you learned something new, or you found it valuable, if you can leave a review, we would really appreciate that, and it's something that helps others find the interview in the search algorithm. So anything you can do to help out with a review, we would just greatly appreciate. And with that, thanks for listening, and I'll catch you again next week.
Thank you for listening to TIP. To access our show notes, courses, or forums, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decisions, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permissions must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.